All right, please be seated. Good morning. This is the time set for the first set of oral arguments this week before the en banc court, and our first case this morning is Scott Raymond Dozier, a.k.a. Chad Wyatt, versus the State of Nevada, case number 50817. Ms. Thomas, are you ready to proceed on behalf of the appellant?
I am, thank you.
All right. I know there's a lot of issues. We set aside 60 minutes, but you might want to focus your attention on some of those that are not necessarily cases where you're asking us to reverse prior authority.
I will do that, Your Honor. I'm sorry, excuse me, Jonelle Thomas, appearing today on behalf of the appellant Scott Dozier. I'm hoping to reserve 10 minutes of time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. I realize this case presents a number of issues. I'm hoping to focus upon four, unless the court has questions as to others. Those concern the unreliable testimony on the cause of death, the improper admission of a gun as evidence, prosecutorial misconduct, and a jury instruction issue concerning voluntary manslaughter. The first issue, which in no way requires this court to overrule its existing authority, is I'm asking the court to simply follow what it did in the civil case of Hallmark versus Eldridge by finding that scientific testimony must be presented, must be based upon reliable methodology and cannot be based upon speculation, conjecture, or assumption. In this case, and I realize the details of this case are graphic, and I don't mean to minimize them at all, but the fact is, in this case, the body that was recovered was missing a head, it was missing the lower arms and the lower legs. These body parts were never recovered. Despite this absence of evidence, the medical examiner, who gave a lengthy list of credentials, testified that Mr. Miller was most likely killed by a gunshot wound to the head. There was no evidence to support this finding, none. She claimed that it was based upon a lack of defensive wounds. And again, I apologize for the graphic nature of the testimony, but the fact is there were no lower arms, which is the place where you would expect there to be defensive wounds. There was no medical, scientific, expert, or any other legitimate basis for this medical examiner to walk into a court of law and say that this man was most probably shot by a gunshot wound to the head. That opinion was not included in the autopsy report. At the time the autopsy was conducted, the opinion was that it was an undetermined cause of death, that it was likely a homicide based upon the dismemberment, but there was nothing suggesting that her opinion at trial would be that it was a gunshot wound to the head. Had such notice been given prior to trial, surely trial counsel would have filed a motion to exclude such testimony. They raised an objection at trial, and the district court simply said it goes to weight, not admissibility. Under Hallmark, there is no way that that ruling can stand. And certainly Hallmark should apply in a criminal case just as it does a civil. They're both based upon, NRS 50.275 applies to both civil and criminal cases. And indeed, in Hallmark, a number of the citations, particularly at footnotes 16 to 25, are two criminal cases. Certainly, if the jury consisted of defense attorneys, prosecutors, judges, people who are used to hearing coroner testimony, there would likely not be much prejudice in this case because the testimony was so bad, so unfounded, that it's likely that any person with knowledge would have ever given it any credibility whatsoever. But the fact is, this is a lay jury, someone not experienced in the parameters of a coroner's testimony, the proper scope of an autopsy finding. And in this case, the prejudice is huge, as her testimony bolstered the only evidence in the case of a gunshot wound, which was a statement of basically a methamphetamine addict who said that Mr. Dozier had stated that that was what happened. I urge you to find that the district court abused its discretion in allowing this evidence without conducting any inquiry as to the basis, and urge you to reverse the judgment on those grounds.
Why wouldn't you consider it a matter of weight as opposed to admissibility? And what was the extent of the cross-examination with Dr. Worrell?
Your Honor, I think that the factors are set forth in Hallmark as to why this is an issue of admissibility and not mere weight. It's because of the extra influence that an expert has. And Ms. Worrell spent many pages of the transcript talking about her background in medical school and her experience in conducting over 3,000 autopsies. And that has a tremendous influence on a jury. The jurors are not schooled in the parameters of an autopsy. And so it's important that the judge have that gatekeeping function and that the state provide a background instead of just speculation when it introduces expert testimony. The scope of the cross-examination pointed out there was no head. And how is it possible that you could find a gunshot wound in the absence of a head? Certainly that argument was made. And I think they, given the surprise of the testimony, given the fact that it was not in the autopsy, I think the trial attorneys did the best they could. Certainly they did not hire another expert to come in and say, that's crazy. There's no basis for that analysis. They didn't realize that was coming forward, and they didn't hire an expert to say that's not a proper finding by a medical examiner. The district court also abused its discretion in allowing the state to introduce as evidence a gun which was never connected to this offense. At the time that Mr. Dozier was arrested in June of 2002, some 2 months after the offense here, he was found with a .40 caliber weapon. That weapon was admitted as evidence in this trial, even though there was no testimony or other evidence indicating that that gun was used in this case. It's important to remember that these events took place shortly after the events of September 11, 2001, at a time when airport security was at an all-time high. Mr. Dozier and his friends flew from Phoenix to Las Vegas. Ms. Douglas, who flew with Mr. Dozier, said he did not have a weapon. And there's no reason to believe that Mr. Dozier would be able to smuggle a gun in his luggage at an airport at this time. The only evidence of a gun in Las Vegas was from Barbara Meager. She, however, testified that the gun that Mr. Dozier carried was chrome or silver, whereas the gun here was black with a silver slide. She stated that she saw a handgun on the table in the room, but she never identified this weapon as being the one that she saw at that time. Under these circumstances, the district court abused its discretion in admitting this evidence. Likewise, at the penalty phase, the state repeatedly introduced evidence of the fact that Mr. Dozier possessed firearms long before the offense at issue here. And I would submit that the use of gun ownership and possession as other matter evidence or bad character evidence in a penalty phase is a violation of the Second Amendment, as we now understand it to be under the District of Columbia versus Heller decision. The next issue I'd like to discuss concerns prosecutorial misconduct, two issues in particular, one from the trial phase and one from the penalty phase. The first concerns the prosecutor's argument about voluntary intoxication. The prosecutor made two arguments about intoxication. First, he argued that there was a lack of evidence that Mr. Dozier was intoxicated, which would be under the use of methamphetamine at the time of the killing. His second argument was that even if intoxication was present, the jury was free to disregard this evidence as a matter of policy if the jury found that the evidence was inappropriate. I'd like to quote more directly as to exactly what he said. This is at 15 Record on Appeal 3324 and 3325. He states, then the instruction says you may consider it. You don't have to. It's a policy decision that's been determined by the legislature. that you may take into account if you think it's appropriate in this case, but you don't have to because it's something that some people might consider inappropriate. And then later he states, you've heard no evidence that the defendant actually was high at the time that he shot Jeremiah, but even if you thought that he was, it's something you may disregard as inappropriate in this case based upon what's happened. Trial counsel should have objected to that argument. They did not. I submit that it constitutes plain error as it's a form of jury nullification. It's informing this jury that despite the fact that there's a jury instruction that says that intoxication is a factor to be considered, you as a matter of policy can decide that you don't want to consider it. Such an argument is unprecedented in this state, and I've cited ample authority from other states stating that such arguments are improper, which this state has not addressed in its answering brief. The next issue of misconduct concerns the issue of jury unanimity on the weighing of aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And to understand this argument, it's more fully understood in the context of the defense closing arguments, as twice defense counsel argued that it just took one juror to take death off the table, one juror to find that the mitigators outweighed the aggravating circumstances, and then the death penalty would no longer be an option. Twice the prosecutors objected to this argument, and twice the district court judge asked that there be a rephrasing or there was a conference at the bench concerning the argument. Then during the prosecutor's closing argument, the prosecutor argued to the juries, and this is at pages 42 to 49 of volume 19, that the weighing was to be done by the jury unanimously. There was no support for that argument, and it's directly contrary to instructions 6, 7, and 8, and more importantly, it's directly contrary to this court's opinion in Evans v. State, which says exactly what the defense attorney said, and directly contrary to what the state argued. If a juror, a single juror, finds that mitigators outweigh aggravators, then the death penalty is no longer an option, and the jurors are to consider the three other sentences. Finally, I'd like to address the issue of the district court's refusal to give an instruction on voluntary manslaughter. Mr. Dozier's counsel requested an instruction on voluntary manslaughter. There was sufficient evidence to warrant such an instruction. The jury here could have easily found that it did not make sense for Mr. Dozier to have planned a murder for Las Vegas. Both men lived in Arizona. They cooked methamphetamine together in Arizona, which is presumably something they would do alone and not with a lot of other people around. Mr. Dozier had access to weapons and other materials in Arizona, including a vehicle, which he lacked in Las Vegas. It would have made far more sense if this murder had truly been planned in advance to do the murder in Arizona rather than to do it at a crowded hotel on the Las Vegas Strip where any number of people could have heard a gunshot, heard a scuffle, otherwise witnessed what was going on. The jury could have also found that it's quite likely that two methamphetamine dealers could have a dispute over the proceeds and the profit after the precursor drugs were obtained, a fight because of the fact that both of them were using methamphetamine and it often leads to aggression. Or they could have found that Mr. Dozier had a paranoid belief that Mr. Miller was a snitch, as he stated to one of the witnesses, and that this created an altercation between them. Under these circumstances, an instruction on voluntary manslaughter was warranted under this court's opinion in Rosas v. State at 147 P3rd 1101 at pages 1105 from 2006.
Ms. Thomas, what would have been the evidence other than methamphetamine use to support the voluntary manslaughter instruction on the issue of provocation?
The evidence in this case is very slight as to what happened between Mr. Miller and Mr. Dozier at the time when Mr. Miller was killed. There's one statement from a person who has a grudge against Mr. Dozier, who's a methamphetamine addict and a convicted felon, stating that Dozier told him that Mr. Miller was sitting in the chair and he shot him. Given that lack of evidence, and given the probabilities or the possibilities of two people who were engaged in a difficult business, a dangerous business, who were both using methamphetamines, the jury could have easily found that an altercation likely occurred.
Was there any testimony of this alleged altercation by anyone?
There is a statement that that Mr. Dozier had said that Mr. Miller was a snitch. And if there was such a belief, it could probably lead to such an altercation. But the record is very slight here.
But there was nothing as to an altercation, just that comment in the record.
Correct. Just as there is virtually nothing to show premeditation or deliberation or to show felony robbery, a robbery occurring as a beforethought rather than an afterthought. The record is very slight as to any of the actions taking place at the time that Mr. Miller was killed. I would suggest, based upon all of this, that the instruction on voluntary manslaughter should have been given. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Well, actually, I did want you to address the robbery issue, if you could. I'd like to clarify what instruction was requested and whether there was a discussion about afterthought robbery.
Actually, this was, as I recall, and Mr. Pesci may have the same memory, when jury instructions for the guilt phase were first settled, defense counsel had proposed an instruction, and if I may.
Mm-hmm. I thought I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I thought the proffered argument or proffered instruction inserted specific intent, but there wasn't an instruction dealing with a distinction between afterthought robbery or otherwise.
What had happened is when jury instructions were settled, defense counsel had requested an instruction on specific intent and on afterthought robbery. The judge denied that. Then the next day, this court issued nay, and the jury instruction was corrected to reflect nay, the one that was given to the jury, to say that afterthought robbery is not sufficient for felony murder. So the nay instruction was given at trial.
Okay.
It's our contention that it should have gone farther, that there should have been an instruction saying that robbery is used for felony murder is a specific intent offense.
Okay.
And I can pull out the language.
I think that clarifies the issue.
And that
for
becomes
me.
Especially important with the intoxication issue, is witness after witness came in and talked about the fact that Mr. Dozier was high on methamphetamine throughout the time that he's in Las Vegas. He's using over and over and over again. Had intoxication been allowed to be considered on the robbery aspect of the case, it's our belief that there's a strong probability that the jury would have found that to be relevant and would not have found that Mr. Dozier acted with specific intent.
Okay, are there any other questions from my colleagues for Ms. Thomas at this time? All right, Mr. Pesci.
Justices, my name is Giancarlo Pesci. I represent the state of Nevada, and unfortunately, I'm going to have to use these glasses. I apologize in advance because my eyes are going. I would like to start, Justice Douglas, where you just left off as far as any actual evidence in the context of the provocation. There was absolutely none, not a single shred of evidence that would articulate somehow a provocation brought on by Jeremiah Miller, the victim, onto the defendant such to reduce this down to a voluntary manslaughter. The concept that somehow after the fact, and this goes to the evidence, not the slight, but the strong evidence of this murder, when the defendant said that Jeremiah was a snitch and he took care of her, There's no way to extrapolate that that somehow produces a provocation. There's nothing in the record.
Wasn't the evidence that he was sitting in a chair and they came up to him, the defendant came up and shot him while he was sitting in a chair?
Correct. The evidence, which was characterized as poor evidence because it came from someone convicted of a felony and a meth addict himself, Joe Walslager. Joe Walslager says defendant admitted to him, Joe Walslager, that the victim was sitting there in the hotel room with the defendant, Scott Dozier. They were talking about the proceeds that they were going to make from this ruse of a deal that was going to go down, which was utilized to bring him up to commit the robbery. That the victim was leaning back, just relaxed, and that he then shot him in the head. There's absolutely nothing that can be extrapolated from that to rise to the level of provocation. So it cannot even be something that should be put in front of the jury. And this court has, in other cases, and very recently, in a case somewhat similar in the sense that the defense in the case before you today was it was not him. In a recent case this court looked at, the defense was it was not me who did this crime. And in that case, the jury or the defense asked for this voluntary manslaughter instruction, and it was denied by the district court. And that denial was upheld by this court because, just like here, there was no evidence, not a shred of evidence, that would support some sort of provocation. Going then to Justice Hardesty's comments about robbery. The beauty of a lengthy trial in this case, which was in fact 4 weeks, was that the date we settled instructions was the day before Your Honors decided nay. So we settled them. There was in fact the requested instruction by the defense about this whole concept of an afterthought. We show up the next day having this decision come down, and we altered our instruction. Thankfully, we argued a day later. It was perfect timing. We would have been in big trouble otherwise. This instruction was perfectly in line with nay. And that evidence was presented to show that there was evidence in advance. And let's go to that, because it's been described as slight. It was the defendant who told the victim, Jeremiah, I, Scott Dozier, have a connect in Las Vegas because I have people that can get ephedrine, which is what's needed to make methamphetamine, which is why the victim had borrowed $12,000 that Scott Dozier knew about to come to Vegas to buy this ephedrine. Scott Dozier chose the location. He picked the La Concha Hotel because he had a friend there, Dean Cernelia, who was the maintenance man. He could come to that hotel off the book, so to speak, without ever anyone knowing officially that he was there. And there were numerous locations. Counsel, unfortunately, was not the counsel of record at the trial, so I don't know that she's as familiar with the fact that the La Concha was separated into three buildings, and there were maintenance rooms that were shut down, which Dean, the friend of Scott Dozier, had access to and gave a card or a key card to Scott Dozier. He could go anywhere there, and there were lots of locations. In fact, a whole tower that was shut down to guests. That's the maintenance area. That's where Scott Dozier insisted to have his room. And in fact, when he was given a room originally, he told Dean, no, I want two adjoining rooms. And he got those two adjoining rooms. He was able to fix that. So he brings the money. He knows the victim has the money. He sets the location. And then when the deal doesn't go down, Jeremiah and his girlfriend Brandy leave. In fact, it is because of some of the workers at the hotel, in fact, Jose Ortiz, who did not know this arrangement that Dean had, and came upon the victim and Brandy and said, what are you doing here? You can't be here, and kicked them out. Scott Dozier confronted Mr. Ortiz and told him, quote, you just cost me $13,000. And then he went on to yell at Dean, saying that his guy, Ortiz, had just cost him $13,000 because the victims left. And it was Scott Dozier who then called all the way to Arizona and pulled his victim back, because he called up and he had messages waiting for Brandy and Jeremiah when they got home, saying, come back, I have another connect. I have someone else who can provide this. To say that this somehow doesn't have the evidence of robbery and premeditation is beyond reality. He pulled him back so that he could do it in the location that he set up. And then there's all kinds of evidence of what he did, which showed that he had the ability to premeditate, which countered the argument of the voluntary intoxication, which is one of the issues brought up. And let's turn to that for just one second. The state of Nevada did not attack the defense of voluntary intoxication. That's how it was portrayed to you. That is not what was done. The prosecutor specifically articulated that you can take into consideration voluntary intoxication in the context of first versus second degree murder. He specifically indicated that you can choose not to find it appropriate in this case. And then what was not put in the answering brief, but what we put in our, I'm sorry, in the opening brief, but we put in the answering brief, was four paragraphs after that policy decision argument or that policy statement was made, four paragraphs of the prosecutor applying the facts of this case to the evidence and arguing and showing how the facts of this case fall completely short of the defense of voluntary intoxication. It was not an attack on the defense. It was an attack on how factually it didn't fit in this case.
Would you concede that the word policy, though, is not the best word to use in that situation? It is jury nullification if you use the word policy.
Justice Cherry, I'm fearful to ever concede anything in front of this court. But what I will say is that he can talk about a policy in the context of there is the policy that the legislature came up with the idea of voluntary intoxication. It's a policy decision that the legislature made. But it's not binding in the sense that it may be considered. It's not must, it's may. So he did not go any further and make an argument about nullification. There was nothing argued about nullification. So respectfully, I disagree. I don't concede that, and I don't think that's what he argued in any way, shape, or form. And on that issue, let's turn to the prosecutorial misconduct. Specifically, there was two incidents of it, and one of them was in penalty, because I think we just touched on the voluntary intoxication portion of it. In the penalty, there was an argument made that is often made, and I dare say some of your justices have actually heard the argument. One of you can take death off the table. In fact, the quote in this case, in addition to that, was, one of you can stop the death train. Now let's analyze that for just one second. There are 12 jurors. 12 jurors must decide unanimously that the aggravators exist, that the mitigators do not weigh them. 12 jurors are not hijacked, or 11 or 10, whatever the equation works out to be, by one. It is absolutely true that one person, 2, 10, whatever, can always say, I don't think death's appropriate. And in fact, there's an instruction that was given, even if you find the aggravators, death is never mandated. What one cannot do is compel the remainder to not have the option of death. That's a misstatement of the law. And here's the perfect example. Dante Johnson. If that statement were accurate, there would not be a Dante Johnson 2. Because in that case, the equation was 11 to 1. 11 for death, 1 for less than death. And each and every person has the right to hold to their position. But they can't hijack and take an option off the table because one of them says, I don't think that's appropriate. They can try to deliberate. If they do not reach a decision, which happened to Dante Johnson, then it is a mistrial. It is a hung jury. That is what the state of Nevada argued. That is what the state of Nevada stopped from being argued, which is one of you doesn't compel the rest to give up your opportunity or your belief or your position that death is appropriate. That's a misstatement of the law. It's completely inconsistent. If one of them doesn't think death is appropriate, fine. He or she can hold her ground to that position. And then there's a mistrial, and we do it again. So there's no misconduct whatsoever. And so it's very clear what the state articulated to the jurors was, in the context of mitigation, any one of them could find mitigation. Just one of them can pick a mitigator that was presented, can add a mitigator that wasn't even there. They do not have to be unanimous as to the selection of a mitigator. That's what the jury was told. Then what I did, and this is my alleged misconduct, is read the verdict form where it says, we, the jury, unanimously determine. The prelude to the verdict form, that's what was read specifically to them. And that is an accurate statement of the law. Whatever their verdict is, it must be unanimous. So there was nothing done inappropriate. There was no misconduct in that regard. In the concept of a gun, there was evidence that a gun was introduced into evidence. The state of Nevada alleged the deadly weapon enhancement. We have an absolute right to to introduce evidence which would make it, under the statute, more probable or not more probable that this fact occurred. We have the defendant in possession of a handgun. You heard a lot about 9/11, just so it's clear. The defendant was able to smuggle post 9/11 methamphetamine to Nevada. That's probably easier to do than a handgun. I will concede that. There's that word concession, Justice. I will concede that. But the own evidence that came in from the defense was that there was methamphetamine there because the defendant smuggled it on the airplane to Nevada. The other thing to keep in mind, this was not a four-hour window. They arrived in Nevada, and they were there for days before Jeremiah left the first time, then was called back by the defendant, and stayed there even longer. The defendant had extensive contacts here in Las Vegas. He had been here in Las Vegas. The penalty phase showed the abundance of his contacts with Nevada, and he had multiple people who were his friends. And in fact, you heard evidence about friends that came to see them, to party with them. He had great opportunity to obtain a weapon if, in fact, he didn't bring it with him on the flight. So it is a piece of evidence that we must show in order for that enhancement to be found. We have an absolute right to present that evidence. And it's not prejudicial because the D.C. case doesn't stand for the proposition that at all times and in all places you get to have a gun and nothing can be used against you about you having a gun. No, if you're charged with using a gun, clearly that evidence is relevant. Furthermore, Scott Dozier, at the time he killed Jeremiah Miller, was a convicted felon. He was on probation. I'm quite certain that the case in D.C. doesn't stand for the proposition that felons now get to have a gun. What was recently overturned in the statute was the concept that if you're a fugitive of justice, which, oh, by the way, Scott Dozier was, but we did not introduce, if you're a fugitive from justice, you can't have a gun. That's been deemed to be inappropriate. That's not what was done here. He was a convicted felon for manufacturing methamphetamine and for possession. He was on probation for that. He did not have a Second Amendment right to possess a gun, and it was not prejudicial at all for that evidence to be presented. Going to the original issue that was brought up, which was the cause of death. With all due respect to Jeremiah Miller and his family.
Before you turn to that issue, Mr. Pesci, it does seem like the state couldn't introduce into evidence any gun without some connection to the crime. I mean, you could have introduced a rifle, you could have introduced, I mean, whatever gun was laying around. What was the connection of this gun to this crime?
Well, you were told one witness. There's actually two witnesses. Barbara Meager and Joe Walslager specifically testified that the defendant said that he used a gun to kill the victim. Then it was a handgun. Back and forth about the actual color, but it was a handgun. And the defendant, as he went on a high-speed chase in Arizona to flee the police, was caught in connection with a handgun. So we have an allegation that a handgun was used. We have evidence from two different individuals that a handgun was an admission by the defendant as the mode of killing. And then we have a handgun in the defendant's possession. So back to the statute, if it's more probable or not. And it goes to the weight, not admissibility. And where's the prejudice? Where is the prejudice by the fact of him being in possession of a gun? I just don't see how there is such prejudice. But let's tie that gun into the coroner, if I could, Justice Hardesty. The coroner testified, and again, I was saying, in respect to Jeremiah Miller and his family, this is graphic. The victim's head was cut off. The victim's arms were disarticulated from the elbows down. No ID from face, no ID from hands. But of course, you're told that there's slight evidence of the premeditation. And his knees, from the knees down, were gone. Yet to be recovered. We still don't have that evidence. The coroner had, in essence, if I could step out, from the knees to the waist, cut directly in half, and from the waist to the head. There was a cut in the torso from about the belly button up. Each and every cut testified by the doctor based on her scientific training and experience was post-mortem. None of those cuts caused death. They're all scientifically founded and sound by her training and experience as being post-mortem because of the lack of hemorrhaging. So what you have is a torso left over. If he was shot in his shin, he's not likely to have died from that. What was the evidence that we had? He was shot in the head. And just so you know, it was not her only opinion. She didn't articulate that it must be a gunshot wound. She said a gunshot or blunt force trauma to the head. We have evidence of a gunshot. All that's left to cause this death is severe damage to the head, consistent with the evidence. And just so it's understood, it's not just what people are saying as far as what the defendant said. You had live testimony from Jerry Wimberly, of a friend of the defendant, an associate in the methamphetamine subculture. Jerry testifies that he's called to the hotel, which Jerry had been to earlier to party with the defendant, and in fact the victim. That he came to the hotel, that Scott Dozier took him in, remember, adjoining rooms, took him into the bathroom of the adjoining room, pulled back the curtain on the shower, and there in the tub was Jeremiah Miller, that Jerry Wimberly recognized, having partied with him earlier. And this is key. Hands still intact, legs still intact, because as he testified, the victim was dead in the tub with his head cut off, seated on his belly with his hands holding. Clearly, it's not an injury to his elbow down or his knee down that caused his death. It was an injury to his head. She had every right, based on her training and experience. It was not a long shot. It was not coming out of nowhere. And you've been told that if the defense had known about this, they would have made a motion. With all due respect, the defense did know about this. This was a long, drawn-out fight at preliminary hearing, way before trial, as to whether or not the doctor could give such testimony. It was fought out at that level. The defense knew about this. And then when it got to trial, it was fought again. And Justice Perrigo, you asked about the cross-examination. She was crossed extensively on this very issue. It was to weight, not admissibility. There was no harm in that coming in that rises to the level to reverse this conviction. There was another allegation, and I wanted to point to this, and I'm not sure if Justice Hardesty, if you had more, because you originally had, in the order, had asked for four for us to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the concept of notice under 250, mm-hmm. and it was specifically in the context of the penalty phase. Mm-hmm. There's two things that are alleged. There's a letter to Desiree Bargiel, and I apologize, there's a lot of names we're throwing at you, but the defendant had lots of acquaintances, shall we say. Desiree Bargiel was a friend of the defendant. She had a letter. In penalty phase, this letter was brought up. The second part was a letter to Barbara Meager, which we'll get back to in a second. Desiree Bargiel's letter was introduced during the penalty phase. The defense never argued that there wasn't proper notice, because the defense had that letter for quite literally over a year. This was in their evidence. They had this letter. They knew about this letter. The defense did object. They objected when it was introduced, and then before the ruling, and let me get the exact languages, Justice, I apologize. Before the exact ruling, defense then made a determination to admit the letter. State moves to admit, objection, pending. Alzora Jackson says, no, Your Honor, actually we want it admitted. And the letter was admitted. And then on cross-examination of Detective Sherwood in the penalty phase, defense counsel made great use to their benefit of that letter. Specifically in the letter, because it, in the state's perspective, what comes with the good comes with the bad. And from our perspective, it was bad evidence. For them, it was great. They got out evidence from that letter that the detective's own colleague, Detective Long, didn't find it to be a threatening letter. He didn't think it was very threatening, and the threat was as to Desiree's boyfriend, not Desiree. But moreover, the defense was able to utilize the letter to get out this evidence in front of the jury. Specifically, that Scott Dozier writes to Desiree, Desiree, you've met my attorneys, Alzora and Clark Patrick. You would honestly think, this is how he says it, paraphrasing to some degree, that they would be fighting so well or so hard for me if I was guilty. That is the evidence complained about right now. There's no way for an argument to be made when, one, they actually introduced it, and two, it was beneficial to their client. Now, on the second issue as far as notice, it goes to a letter written to Barbara Meager. Barbara Meager was another friend of the defendant. He'd come and go in his life. They kind of had a symbiotic relationship with methamphetamine and their relations. She came into his life again during this visit, and she's the one that the defendant made the admission that he shot him, and he actually kicked the suitcase when she asked where he was in the hallway between the rooms. Barbara Meager received a letter from the defendant. The letter was not in the notice because the letter was not introduced in the case, the guilt case in chief. It was rebuttal evidence. Now, you've heard about the letter being referenced during the state's guilt phase of penalty, and that's accurate because the letter was shown to Detective Sherwood to compare with another letter that Barbara Meager had gotten to make a comparison. However, it was not admitted at that time. And in fact, an objection was made as to the admission of this letter. But that happened, the actual arguments, after the defense put on its case in chief and mitigation. Specifically, they said the defendant is not a threat from jail, and they said that his family treasures the letters that he writes, that he writes good letters. With all due respect, I'm sure they do. However, thankfully, his family hasn't seen the other letters that he writes. Because in response, in rebuttal, the state put on the letter that the defendant had written to Barbara Meager, in which he threatens to come back from, quote, whichever ring, or I can't remember the exact wording if it was ring, but whatever dimension of hell that they send him, he would come back to haunt her. And good luck in the rest of her life. She should follow her brother who had committed suicide. Now, that was to rebut that he wasn't a threat from jail because that was written when he was incarcerated. And that was to rebut the idea that he writes virtuous, kind letters. It is unconscionable that the state of Nevada has to divine into the future what the mitigation case will be and then in its notice put a rebuttal notice. There's nothing in Rule 250 that requires that. And there's no way, with all due respect, to know exactly what the defense is going to do. You can guess, you can have an idea, but there's no way that we can see into the future and therefore, in advance, do a rebuttal notice. There was no violation of Rule 250 in that context. There are a couple of other issues that I wanted to hit on really quickly. Beyond a reasonable doubt, the whole concept of weighing in the penalty phase, having to weigh beyond a reasonable doubt. This court has recently addressed that issue. This court in the past has denied that issue. There is no case law that says that they have to do that, that the jury has to. In fact, there's case law to the contrary. What was articulated to this jury was, in fact, the state of the law at this time. Court's indulgence. And lastly, the one thing I wanted to hit on very quickly, the corpus delicti. This court has previously indicated that the corpus delicti rule does not apply to the enhancement. And I believe to some degree, Justice Hardiston, you've told us to not necessarily focus on those ones where it's trying to reverse precedent that's already in place. So right. Just wanted to point that precedent out. And with that,
One final question from me, at least. When the briefing was concluded, there was uncertainty about the outcome of the Arizona conviction. Do you know the status of that? Are counsel able to agree on the status of that?
I believe it's still in place. I don't believe it's been reversed. And if I could just add on that, because I still have 5 minutes, there is an argument made that the state of Nevada should not have been able to put forth the evidence of the actual aggravator of the prior murder. Mm-hmm. Curiously, we're told that a judgment of conviction should suffice. We shouldn't be able to get all the evidence that supports the actual aggravator. By the same token, on page 72 of the appellant's brief, they argue to you that it might not be a valid conviction. So how can I rely upon a JOC that they're arguing isn't even valid? And if in the context of notice, which is why this is argued, in the context of Rule 250, this court would have to, in essence, reverse itself in the context of Cortinas and Hidalgo. Cortinas, this court said that for the purposes of putting someone on notice of intent to seek death, it was not sufficient for the state to say, we're going to rely upon a judgment of conviction and a summary of judgment of conviction and the police reports. We were told that wasn't enough. So be it. In response, this notice of intent to seek death on the concept of the prior murder is 6 pages long. And not what happened in Hidalgo. It's not Endor, Endor, Endor. It's very, very specific. It's page upon page of the summary of the actual testimony from the trial in Arizona, of the prior murder. If, in fact, the JOC is not sufficient for notice purposes, how could it be sufficient for proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is our burden for an aggravator? And all of the evidence associated with establishing that aggravator is admissible and is appropriate and should come in. Because think about it. If the state of Nevada just held up the JOC and put it down, wouldn't there be an argument made, or couldn't you foresee an argument made, the state failed in its burden? The state didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, in fact, there was a prior murder. And that's why the notice had all of that evidence, and that evidence was presented to this jury. And unless there are any other questions.
Any other questions from my colleagues? All right. Thank you, Mr. Pesci.
Thank you.
Ms. Thomas, your response.
Thank you. I'd like to go in the order just presented by Mr. Pesci. First is to the issue of provocation. And Mr. Pesci argues that there was ample evidence of premeditation based upon going to the La Concha, based upon the trip to Las Vegas. All of that evidence, however, is perfectly consistent with someone who's coming here to buy drugs, who's someone who wants to buy ephedrine so they can make their methamphetamine back in Phoenix. None of that necessarily shows that they were planning a murder. In fact, given the fact that the girlfriend was invited along the first time, it's doubtful that that would be the case. And it's also important to remember the testimony was that Mr. Dozier allegedly told this other person, Mr. Miller was sitting in a chair and I shot him. There's nothing to corroborate that statement. There's no ballistics. There's no blood evidence. There's no physical evidence where this took place to at all suggest that such an act actually took place. Nothing at all. The crime scene here was very unusual, the alleged crime scene, in that there is nothing found in this old hotel with cinder block walls and flocked wallpaper. Not a speck of blood is located in that room. They have this body being drained of every ounce of blood in that room, and yet there's not a single speck of blood found in that room. And without that kind of corroboration, the jury could have easily found that that testimony was not reliable and was certainly far short of proof beyond a reasonable doubt of premeditation. The jury could have also used its everyday common sense and made reasonable inferences that sometimes drug dealers who are high on methamphetamine, who the testimony was it can make people hyped and aggravated, they very well could have had a dispute, especially as their drug deal is falling apart and that they're trying to get the drugs, they're falling apart, they're finding other people. And in taking all of these circumstances into consideration, a jury could have found that the state failed to meet its burden of proof of premeditation and deliberation, and that this was not an act of voluntary manslaughter. Excuse me for one moment. As to the issue on voluntary intoxication, Mr. Pesci tells you that the prosecutor here was simply arguing there was insufficient evidence of intoxication. And I agree, absolutely, that was part of his argument. But then he states, then you may, the instruction says you may consider it You don't have to. It's a policy decision that's been determined by the legislature that you may take into account if you think it's appropriate. And then later, even if you thought that he was high at the time he shot Jeremiah, it's something you may disregard. What he's telling the jury there is if you don't like the fact that methamphetamine intoxication is a consideration when you're deciding whether someone's guilty of first-degree murder or not, if you don't like that, you can just throw it out and ignore it. That is not the law. This court has said intoxication is relevant to the issue of premeditation and deliberation. There is no support for such an argument. In the cases I've cited, I'll go through that analysis. Some people don't think insanity should be an excuse to commit murder. And so prosecutors have argued you may consider insanity. You don't have to do it. And the courts have shut it down and said that's not appropriate. And it wasn't appropriate here for that argument to be made. As to the weighing equation, excuse me a moment. In Evans v. State, and it's a case I know well because I was counsel in that case, this court set forth jury instructions that are still to this day given in every capital case. This instruction was given in instruction number 8. Pursuant to this court's order, the jury here was instructed, if you did not decide unanimously that at least one aggravating circumstance has been proved beyond a reasonable doubt, or if at least one of you determines that the mitigating circumstances outweigh the aggravating, the defendant is not eligible for a death sentence. Upon determining the defendant is not eligible for death, you are to consider all three types of evidence in determining a sentence other than death, and you must decide such sentence unanimously. It is this court who has said if one juror says that aggravators outweigh the mitigators, or the reverse, excuse me, then death is off the table. It does not say there shall be a hung jury and you shall go back and send this back to another jury. It says you shall go on and deliberate as to the three other sentences. That is directly out of Evans. And at no point, not here and not in the state's answering brief, certainly not in the district court, has the state ever presented this court with a case that says to the contrary. That is the state of the law. It was misconduct for the prosecutor to argue to the contrary. The gun. The prosecutor would have you believe that Mr. Dozier got a gun in Las Vegas. Maybe he did. They don't explain how that gun got back to Arizona, which again, Mr. Dozier flew back to Phoenix. The testimony was that he smuggled liquid methamphetamine in a hydrogen peroxide bottle. Certainly that is a far easier task than smuggling a large 40 caliber weapon in your luggage on an airplane. There was no testimony tying that gun to this case. And absolutely, Mr. Dozier was prejudiced by the admission of that testimony. He was prejudiced because that gun sat on the table during deliberations and lended credibility to the statement of a methamphetamine addict felon who made the uncorroborated claim that Mr. Dozier said that he shot Mr. Miller. The presence of that gun mattered. I made a Second Amendment argument. It was not over the admission of a gun. It is certainly not my contention that a gun may not be admitted in a murder trial. That by no means am I arguing that. Certainly, if you can tie a gun through ballistics, through eyewitness, through some other evidence to an offense, it should come in. But that was not done here. My Second Amendment argument goes to the gun's evidence that was admitted during the penalty phase. That had nothing to do with this case, that had to do with Mr. Dozier being arrested, albeit not convicted most of the time, and having guns in his possession at times when he was arrested for drug offenses. those weapons had no basis to be introduced in this penalty phase. That's a violation of the Second Amendment, and just as this, the U.S. Supreme Court held in Dawson v. Delaware that a violation of the First Amendment won't be tolerated in a penalty phase, so too should a violation of the Second Amendment also not be tolerated. The medical examiner. There are a number of ways that Mr. Miller could have been killed other than a gunshot wound to the head. His wrists could have been slit, there are major veins in the legs, he could have been strangled. The list could go on and on. Certainly this court has encountered many, many a murder case where someone was killed not by means of a gunshot wound to the head. The medical examiner stated, "It is my opinion that the cause is due to a head injury, most likely and most probably a gunshot wound to the head." There is no basis for that testimony. And just as in Hallmark, this court said unfounded scientific evidence should not be admitted, this testimony should not have been admitted here. Mr. Pesci said something that I thought was interesting. He noted that Jerry Wimberly said he went into the hotel room, saw the body in the tub, saw the arms, and saw the legs. What he didn't testify to was seeing a gunshot wound to the head. Here's someone who supposedly saw this skull, saw this head, no testimony of seeing a gunshot wound. Based upon all of the facts of this case, the fact that this finding is not in the autopsy, that testimony should never have been admitted. As to the rule regarding Supreme Court Rule 250 and notice of the letters that were introduced, the state introduced this evidence, not the letters themselves, but evidence of the letters through the detective's testimony. That was not noticed under Rule 250. This was not just rebuttal to the mitigation. It wasn't just rebuttal to the letters that Mr. Dozier has sent to his family. The state elicited this testimony from a detective during its case in chief. And certainly there is no rule that says if an item is provided in discovery during a preliminary hearing, that's sufficient to give notice to defense counsel that the state intends to present that evidence during the penalty phase of a capital trial. The state touched upon a couple of other issues. The beyond a reasonable doubt and weighing equation, I recognize that this court recently made the ruling. I still wish to preserve that issue. The federal courts have not addressed it. I think under Apprendi, there's an argument that they would find to the contrary. The Arizona case is still pending on the post-conviction matters. And finally, as to the evidence that came in, under Redeker, the judgment of conviction and documents such as the information, the jury verdicts, those would be relevant to show that this conviction took place. The judgment of a conviction itself shows that this judgment took place, and defense counsel acknowledged that. There's case law that says if a judgment is reversed and it serves as an aggravator, that aggravator has to be thrown out. That's all we're doing in preserving this issue. And the issue we raised was that all of the other allegations about what happened in Arizona should have been presented as character evidence, as other matter evidence. It shouldn't have been a part of the weighing equation, as it was the fact of the judgment and not the details that were relevant under that aggravator. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Thomas? I'd like to thank both counsel for their briefs and their arguments here today. I have a question of both counsel, which is unrelated to the merits of the appeal, but we have been attempting to initiate a new process, at least in en banc cases, where we've added questions or directed counsel's attention to certain issues in the notice of oral argument. Did you find that helpful, useful, a distraction? Would you care to comment? And if you don't wish to comment, you certainly don't have to. But
but the court's interested in counsel's feedback on this.
Your Honor, I do think it's helpful. I mean, obviously, I picked my top issues were different, and I may view things differently, but I do think it's a helpful process.
It's extremely helpful, especially when there's over 20 alleged issues that are in the case. So it's great to be able to focus on certain.
Okay, well, thank you. The case will stand submitted.